Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We continue now with our 30 Issues election series. It's issue 26 this week. How many immigrants are right for America? And who and why? And who is immigration for? Already this week, we presented an audio history of immigration politics, compared the positions of Trump and Clinton, and taken calls from some of you about your family's immigration stories. Today, we'll have a debate on some of these basic questions. How much immigration? Most people don't even know how many immigrants are coming in, legally or illegally, every year. What's the ideal number? Which immigrants? Why? And for the benefit of whom? I hope we can get beyond some of the usual cable TV talking points to some of these deeper things. So let's give some of this a try. With me is Tom Jowett, Vice President for Immigration at the Center for American Progress, the liberal think tank founded by Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. And we're expecting any second Juan Pablo Andrade, executive advisor for the National Diversity Coalition for Trump. So for now, Tom, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I should just clarify also that I'm speaking in my capacity with the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
Fair enough. And let me start with a clip from Ronald Reagan's farewell address in 1989. He talked about this vision that he had referred to so often of America as a shining city on a hill. And relevant to the debate in this campaign, he referred to building a wall, or more generally, if that city on the hill should have walls.
And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
So what's changed from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump on the basic idea there that anyone with the will and the heart to get here obviously wants to be here, so will be a boon to our country?
Yeah, I mean, it's the Republican Party's position on immigration is unrecognizable from what it was, certainly under President Reagan, and frankly under the George W. Bush administration as well, who, as a Texan, as a person who has family members who are themselves Mexican, seem to appreciate that the issue was more complicated, I think, than what the party in recent years has turned to. I think one thing to me that I think was striking was in 2012, after the last presidential election, the party preference and the turnout of Latino and Asian voters was quickly understood as being essentially such a big problem for the national GOP ticket that they would have to begin to champion immigration reforms, essentially put the issue aside so that this population would begin to listen to them on other issues that they want to try to speak to them on. And that momentum that came after that election really did successfully push an immigration reform bill through the Senate, and it got momentum moving in the House as well for a period of time. But a counter-narrative, I think, set in, and you started hearing this really in the days after the election in 2012, 2013, that another strategy that the Republican Party could pursue is this the missing white voter theory, this idea that Republicans could be okay on the national ticket if they could just increase white voter turnout and increase party preference by white voters. And the policy recommendation that flowed from that was that, I think it was a very cynical one, if you just become more divisive, if you adopt more of an America first anti-immigrant message, then you'll essentially drive people to their own corners, and that's the way you can really ramp up white turnout and white party preference. And I think it's that strategy that, frankly, I think helps to understand what we're seeing in this race. And I think especially given where we're seeing white women voters, college-educated women going, that may be the strategy that at the end of the day proves to be so disastrous for this ticket.
For the Republican ticket. Yeah, well, that's an interesting statement of it, less in values terms and more in sheer political strategy terms. And I need to let listeners in on something that's going on behind the scenes here with this segment, which is that this was booked as a debate, and we have been expecting, and we thought we had confirmed, Juan Pablo Andrade, executive advisor for the National executive advisor for the National Diversity Coalition for Trump, on that side. And we had checked in with him earlier, and everything seemed to be fine, and we're not able to make a phone connection with him right now. So, Juan, if you're hearing me on the radio, please get in touch. Except I think he's in Cleveland. And what we'll try to do in the name of fairness, in the interest of fairness, is let listeners call up and answer from the more, let's say, immigration skeptic position. As we continue with at least our one guest, Tom Jowett, Vice President for Immigration at the Center for American Progress, the liberal think tank founded by Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta and the American Progress Action Fund. So listeners who especially support Trump or Trump-like views of immigration in this country, let me replay that Ronald Reagan clip from 1989, and I invite you to call and respond to this. If Ronald Reagan was the conservative icon who sort of got things right in a lot of Republicans' worldviews, was he wrong about this?
And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
Why not open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here? Meanwhile, while calls are coming in, Tom, I think we wouldn't be having such a big national debate about illegal immigration if people weren't concerned about the total number of immigrants. According to an analysis of census data that I read in preparing for this, there are about 42 million immigrants in the U.S. now, or about 13% of the total U.S. population, which is the highest percentage in about 100 years, the height of the Ellis Island time. We had more than a million legal immigrants last year alone, plus the ones coming illegally. So setting aside the question of legal or illegal, do we have a healthy number of immigrants coming right now, or too many immigrants, or too few, in your own opinion? And is that really what's driving this national debate?
Yeah, I think part of what's driving this national debate is I think the campaign basically is trying to drive it in a way to divide people along the lines that I was describing earlier. One really important point, I think, and this came out in a very recent study that the National Academy of Sciences put together on the economic and fiscal impact of immigrants in the United States, is that the immigrant population in the United States is a strong, strong net positive economically for the country in terms are just growing the economy and creating jobs. And one of the things that I think was actually one of the more striking charts from that paper that they came up with is that if you look decade by decade, in the current decade that we're in, 2010 to 2020, basically all net growth in the working age population of this country comes from immigrants and their children. Third generation Americans, we're basically seeing a negligible growth essentially in the working age population. When you look at 2020 to 2030, you project out just 5 years from now, 2020 to 2030, but for immigrants and their children coming into the workforce and contributing taxes, contributing to our Social Security and Medicare trust funds, but for them, we would actually lose a net 7 million working-age Americans in this country.
And so, many countries in Europe and in Japan, where there's also very low birth rate without immigration, there's a much bigger problem than there is in this country, projected with their Social Security and their equivalent of Medicare, because there are fewer and fewer workers to retirees.
That's exactly right. And what the study found is that when you look at immigrants, the skills that they're bringing that complement the skills of the American workforce, when you look at the propensity for entrepreneurship, for business creation, those are all areas in which you see a tremendous benefit. And the benefit that we see from first-generation immigrants is far surpassed by the benefit we see from second-generation immigrants who, for whatever reason, seem to have something special about the ability to really marry both their full sort of American background with the ability to really sort of strive and achieve at extremely high levels. And so these are things that we as a country should be proud of. They're part of our history as a country. They're part of what makes us who we are. And New York certainly knows that as well as or better than most.
Let's take a phone call. Joe in Sutton Place. You're on WNYC. Joe, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Two things very quickly. One is that in actual fact, the argument that you need high levels of immigration for economic growth are not really valid. Just for a little economic history, USA had much lower levels of immigration in the 45 to 73 period, but had much higher rates of economic growth per annum in that period than you have in the subsequent period after 1973, where you have much lower growth and much higher levels of immigration. So per se, empirically speaking, there is no valid argument to be made that one necessarily results in the other.
Tom?
I'm not sure what period he's talking about. I mean, I think it sounds like some of the period he's talking about actually is encompassed by the baby boomer generation. And so some period of that, I think, is when we actually had a huge number of American workers coming into the workforce through that.
Well, I think he's saying we're having slower economic growth, more low-skilled jobs are being done by automation. And so, at the same time that it's harder for people with relatively little education to get by in this economy, we're having more low-skill immigration than we did in the 1970s and the decades immediately before that. So it's really a mismatch.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess there's 2 points. On the first point, I think the point he was making before that, though, was that you don't necessarily need more immigrants in order to have economic growth. And I think the period that he was talking about is a period when you had so many American workers coming into the workforce through the baby boomer generation that that was what was driving so much of that growth in the workforce. In terms of the issue of immigrant labor competing with American workers, the National Academy of Sciences did study this and did find that on net, you do not see an impact on the American jobs or American wages from immigration. There were some exceptions to that. There are some exceptions for a slightly negative impact on previous generations of immigrants and on Americans with less than a high school education. And that is true. That is something that I think that's been a consensus of the literature for some time. Having said that, that is also a significantly shrinking portion of the American public. Now, that's not an issue to ignore for that reason, I think. And, you know, obviously, I think there are broader social policies that the Center for American Progress and others push in order to try and advance people's ability to get education, to get the support they need in order to strive, in order to achieve more. But I think it is useful context, though, that in general, for the vast majority of the American public, the benefits in terms of jobs, in terms of wages, in terms of consumption as well. So one of the findings of the National Academy of Sciences report is that the kinds of services and goods that Americans consume on a daily basis are made more affordable, essentially, by the presence of immigrants, not just as workers, but also by consumers as well, by increasing demand and therefore bringing down the cost of goods and services.
Jay in Hillsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I'm an independent, but I guess I'm more conservatively minded with respect to immigration. I would prioritize American safety. So I wouldn't just roll the dice and have people come in from dangerous, war-torn areas of the world on the fear that some of those people may pose dangers to American citizens. And I don't believe that, with all the screening in the world, and we could, eliminate that risk. And I don't see why we would tolerate even a small risk compared to the numbers of people from those war-torn areas. I just don't understand it. We're the American people. We're the voters. We make up the country. We're putting our politicians in office, and we're the politicians themselves. So. I don't see, mm-hmm. It's the United States of America. It's not the United States of the world.
And you wanted to say to my screener, you said to my screener something about targeting high-tech immigrants.
The other thing I would say is that, the reason why we're the number one economy at the moment in the world is because we occupy the highest levels of technology. And I don't see anything wrong with allowing big business to go wherever they need to go in order to get workers that are going to make their businesses flourish. whether it be in homegrown talent in the U.S. or anywhere around the world. I mean, why in the world would we not let them do that? I don't buy the argument that it may squeeze American talent. You know, it's a competitive world, and we want you know, the talent to be here in the U.S. And you know, part and parcel with the immigration policy kind of dovetails with other policies, and you know, Trump's, some of his policies are kind of contradictory. So I do agree that you had said earlier that the world is becoming more and more mechanized, and lower wage workers are getting squeezed. The reason we're on top is because we have the best, highest, the best educated workers, the best high tech industries, and that's where we're making our money. But if we allow the companies in these industries that are flourishing to take their tax dollars to other countries, then we're defeating the whole purpose of trying to build these industries for the sake of our country.
Jay, thank you very much. And let's take his two main points there, and that's going to fill the rest of the time that we have, Tom. But two big points. One on, you know, the particular whether we should express a preference for immigrants with certain skills, and the even more foundational one that he raised at the beginning, who is immigration for? And let me play a short clip of Donald Trump, who speaks very explicitly about this.
There is only one core issue in the immigration debate, and that issue is the well-being of the American people. Nothing even comes a close second. Hillary Clinton, for instance, talks constantly about her fears that families will be separated. But she's not talking about the American families who have been permanently separated from their loved ones because of a preventable homicide.
So America, I mean, immigration policy is for the benefit of Americans already here. And that should be the starting point of the conversation about what policy we should have, according to Trump. The caller said, hey, we're the United States of America. We're not the United States of the world. Do you think immigration policy should just be based on that premise or something more? I mean, the inscription at the base of the Statue of Liberty is, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, which suggests that the U.S. stands for something more than just a strict self-interest, national interest set of rules that somehow we are here to provide a universal good, given our immigrant history.
Yeah, so those are two big topics, I think. I mean, you know, the world is becoming smaller, and it's becoming more globally interconnected. And so what is good for the American people, first and foremost, is often what is good for the world. But also, what is good for the American people when the American people are constituted by a large immigrant and diverse population can mean family unity, for instance. It can mean making sure that people are able to bring their spouses and their children and their brothers and sisters to the country so that they can live with them here and help to support each other and bring their parents here as well. You know, in terms of high-skilled immigration, I mean, no question. I think our immigration system should work for the benefit of the country. And if the immigration system was modernized in such a way that it would actually reflect the reasonable needs, the reasonable demands of business, of families, of communities, it would actually be able to unlock a huge amount of potential for the country.
But those two things are at odds, aren't there? Because the controlling immigration law is based on family unification since 1965. We talked a lot about this in our history segment yesterday. But family unification preference doesn't necessarily give us the skilled immigrants that we need. There's a history in some communities more than others of people get in first because they have a certain skill that enables them to get a foothold, and then a lot of brothers and sisters and others who get a family preference come in, and they don't necessarily have the skills, and they're not necessarily the same contributors to the American economy. So are those things contradictory?
I don't think they're contradictory. I think you just need a system that's balanced. And we don't now have a system that is purely family-based by any means. We do have an employment-based immigration system that absolutely needs to be improved. But I think it all needs to be improved in a way that at the end of the day, provides the kind of balance that we want from our system. Because really, one of the major reasons why we have a situation now where we have 11.1 million unauthorized immigrants in the country is that we don't have a lawful means for people to actually meet the demands that we as a society legitimately have. We have demands for families to be kept together. We have demands for businesses to hire people. And on the first point the caller made regarding how the United States should approach countries in conflict, first and foremost, the caller has some skepticism to it, but with respect to Syrian refugees in particular, for instance, we have a very robust set of screening in place that takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years for a person to get through before they can come to the country. And the kinds of fears, this idea that there might be someone who's posing, they may pose a danger, and therefore no one should come, that Donald Trump has expanded to his Muslim ban, the idea that people who are Muslim or who are from certain countries should be categorically banned from coming to the country, is in many ways, frankly, it's very similar to the kind of rhetoric you saw in the United States in the beginning of World War II, when polls showed the American public generally opposed strongly the idea of allowing Jewish children even to come into the country. And we had the terrible incident where a ship was turned away when it could see the lights of the country.
Is it a fair comparison? Because the Jews were unambiguously the victims of Nazism. If it was, maybe the more direct parallel would be if a lot of Germans were coming into the country, non-Jewish Germans at that time, and you couldn't tell the Nazis from.
The parallel could frankly be how we dealt with Japanese Americans, right, at the time, which was a period of internment that Canada as well has indicated would may have been an appropriate way of considering how dealing with population. In general, I think on a humanitarian basis, the United States has international obligations as a signatory, within the United Nations as under the Refugee Convention and our own laws.
Right. So we just have 30 seconds left, but I'm curious as a matter of principle if you would pick those two things apart or lump them together. That is, if we accept the idea that we do have international obligations with respect to refugees, what about non-refugee immigration? Do we also have international responsibilities with respect to regular immigration, or should that just be done on the basis of the national interest, in your opinion?
We do not have international obligations with respect to non-refugees. I think it should very much be done with an eye on what is in the national interest. And I think then when looking at the national interest, you have to look at the studies and look at the positive benefit that immigration and immigrants bring to the country economically, socially, culturally, and otherwise.
Tom Jowitz, Vice President for Immigration at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito next. Stay with us.